Late Problem, eine Witzweil von Scheichus mit Zack und Laura. Articulate Bobbling.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the latest episode of Articulate Warbling.
Of Articulate Warbling. That was a very deep, sonorous sigh.
I had to think so hard because we haven't done one in such a long time.
So long, yes. Hi, I am Zach.
That leaves me. I'm Laura.
And this is a long overdue podcast.
So I sit here with my ankle resting on an ice pack following a gracious fall this afternoon. I wish you could have seen it, because I thought it was hella gracious. Like, my foot went, I thought, oh no, and I just gently lowered myself down to the ground where I sat saying, ow, and mum.
And mum was there.
She was out the door. She was ready. She watched me go down, apparently, which is a little bit concerning.
Wile E. Coyote style, because now there's a, like, Jane-shaped hole in the door.
Anyway, we have got a lot to go through today. So
we have indeed.
I think this will definitely be a two-parter.
Maybe.
If not even more.
Maybe.
So let's start off with His Dark Material, shall we?
We shall.
So, season one.
Season one, yeah. When was that released? That's 2019. Of Philip Pullman's best-selling series entitled His Dark Materials. But separate volumes, you may know them as Northern Lights, The Subtle Knife, and The Amber Spyglass. And his recent foray into the sequel verse and the prequel verse is The Book of Dust, La Belle Sauvage, and The Secret Commonwealth. Philip Pullman is like a best-selling, world-renowned children's novelist. He's up there with David Almond as a writer of good repute. You know, he's respected, he's good at what he does, and those of you who haven't read the books, you may be familiar with it. It was adapted into a 2007 film called The Golden Compass. Now a lot of people dislike that film.
Me being one of them.
And really give it the thumbs down. Mostly their criticism is really, like, baseless. Oh, it hasn't got the pseudo-religioso stuff in it. It's there. I mean, for how close the Golden Compass sticks to the Northern Lights book, I'm really surprised that the fans took so awfully to it. But we have now got a supposed real, genuine, full-on, fuck-you, organised religion imbued television series, the actual, real adaptation of Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials. I've read the books. I'm a fan of the books. Wasn't so much a fan of The Golden Compass. Up and watching the first season, I better appreciate The Golden Compass rather than what they tried to achieve outside of what had already been achieved relatively well in The Golden Compass. I don't have much to say about season one. I think it's it strives to be as far from the movie as possible whilst actually, you know, it was such a close adaptation. You can't differ it to the... If you stay so close to the source material, I really think you need to throw, like, a spanner into the works. And they kind of did with the gradual implementation of the narrative threads of The Subtle Knife, but that was more of the... If I remember, it was the latter half of season one, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. They started putting in the elements about Will and all that. I think if they started with that... Because this is another issue of season two for me. They spend too long in that other reality. Okay, also, spoiler alert, people, you know this by now. That could have been weaved better into season one for me. I think they striving to be as distant from the film adaptation, and they kind of just lost sight of, you know, imbuing it with something a little edgier. But that is why I like season two more than one, because it's covering territory we haven't seen adapted for big or small screen. And I really liked the casting choices, the development of it. There are a lot of issues, but season one for me, not a big fan of it. I like the setup. I like it when the subtle knife stuff. And it's because the Golden Compass is so loyal to the book, to a fault, actually, to a fault, that any other adaptation you can't really...
That's the problem, though, isn't it? I think... I mean, I haven't read the books. I watched The Golden Compass a very long time ago.
It isn't a fun film. It's boring.
It's boring, yeah. But I think, for me, I think no matter what you're talking about, if you are too loyal to a book in an adaptation, you can't ever revisit it or revamp it or remake it. And then you've always got the fact that the thing is, you can't make an entire book an entire film.
No.
Because the thing is books give you a lot of information that you need for your imagination. If you make that entire book into a film, it is going to be boring. And that could be said for the best book known to mankind.
Well, that's why I think that long-form storytelling in television series is perfect for book adaptations. Absolutely. But that's not always the case. We have The Hunger Games, we have the Twilight films.
Yeah, but there are things in the books that you don't see in the films.
It's quite densely packed.
And
sometimes
you see things in the films that didn't really happen in the books. It was a different character, it was a different this, different that.
They did do a lot of switching in The Golden Compass, which is why people do believe that it didn't adhere to the adaptation. Yeah. Also the whole religious theme. The religious connotations in Philip Pullman's books is negative. And people criticise the lack of it in the movie.
But that just would have made it even more tedious than it already was.
I believe so. I think the greatest issue is, though this is a huge shadow it's cast, it's not cast in a positive light.
Hmm.
It's cast because they've adhered to the point A to point B to point B to point C point D. So specific, it is a direct adaptation of the book. It may lack characters, may be subsumed into a whole new character. The issue is they've got this great shadow and they've been put in a predicament where they've gone, well, we're going to do the adaptation that the fans feel they didn't get.
Mm.
Well, you're doing that, but you're just prolonging the inevitable. What I found boring in The Golden Compass, I'm finding even more boring and struggling with in season one. They focus on the wrong aspects. I think they didn't lean in. I think they should have given Jack Thorne, is it Thorne or Thorpe, the main writer? I think it's Jack Thorpe. Thorne?
I think it might be Thorpe.
Thorpe. What he does in season two, because they're adapting material that hasn't been on the big screen, that's where he's kind of gone, oh yeah, let's loosen up. Why didn't you do that anyway when you adapted the first book?
Mm.
Mm, loosen up. In its striving to be as far away from what was wrong with The Golden Compass, they've actually highlighted those issues and, if anything, perpetuated them and made them even more dull. It kicks off relatively well when the material that those of us who are fans and have watched Amber, have watched The Golden Compass, have read The Amber Spyglass, read The Subtle Knife, read Northern Lights, when it starts going into territories out of which we haven't seen on the big screen.
It was Thorne, apologies.
It was Thorne, so it's not Thorpe, Jack Thorne. Similar. Anyway. But Thorpe sounded better. Jack Thorpe.
It did, didn't it? That's why I was like, it's Thorpe. And then I googled it. I'm like, it's Thorne. Sorry.
Jack Thorne has literally gone, what did they criticise about the movie? Okay, I'm going to deal with that. But why are you dealing with those specifics? You're going from that whole point A to point B to point B to point C to point C to point D. It's not shaken up a bit. Also, I felt that there was just a little bit miscast actors for the sake of casting them. It added nothing to the story. It was just ticking boxes.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, as soon as it's out of that shadow of what's already been brought to the screen, it's brilliant.
Mm.
Because Jack and the creative crew are doing this. They're rolling their shoulders and they're like going...
Clicking their fingers
and it's like, okay, I can go for it now. Yeah. I think what they should have done is felt comfortable in adapting it as they would want to. I think this goes into that fanboy thing that you have an issue with. What are the fans going to like? People are too loyal to it. And they get so hung up on these things, they lose sight of the bigger picture.
It actually reminds me of a conversation we had the other day about reading books, ironically, about how I read everything as fiction, despite the fact that I read non-fiction books too. And I think there's an element of when I watch something, and, I mean, remove the whole fiction, non-fiction thing, but when I watch something, I try and forget that I've ever read anything to do with it. And that's part of the reason why I don't like watching trailers.
Yeah.
I don't like reading too much into the synopsis.
Mm.
I try not to have much in the way of loyalty.
You don't need that back catalogue. You just want to go in cold.
Mm. Whereas you, on the other hand, are a lot more different from that.
Obsessive compulsive and needing to know the ins and outs of a duck's arsehole way before the film's even
But I find
been shown.
That can often ruin it for me.
Mm.
And actually having...
I understand that, and I do get that sometimes with certain things I watch.
Yeah.
I have on occasion turned around and gone, I just ruined that for myself, didn't
I? Yeah, and I think that's the thing, and that comes into a conversation that we've had previously on the podcast and outside of the podcast about loyalties and stuff, because the more loyal you are towards someone, something, so you know, certain writers,
you're
certain
setting, it up, time, you're
setting it up to fail, almost.
Yeah, you are, definitely, and not just for the piece of art itself, for yourself, for you, subjectively.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's the thing, it's a bit like when we went to go and watch Tenet, it's like you were really kind of, you know, you were bigging it up because it's Christopher Nolan, it's going to be massive, it's going to be a
I really
Inception.
Thought it was like a return to form.
Yeah,
and
but
if anything, it is just...
Not.
it's just a product of what was wrong with Dunkirk, which we'll go into later.
But if you remember when we were sat in the car outside the cinema and I said... I don't want to think about it, and I'm not going to have too higher expectations.
Yeah.
And actually, that meant that although the film was still shit, I wasn't disappointed because I don't have those loyalties.
Yeah.
And I think that does benefit me sometimes.
Yeah, it does.
Because having not
I think that's
books,
why you're a good co-host.
Probably, because I give a different opinion, and it's perhaps sometimes a bit more objective. But I think the thing is, I mean, it's difficult to say, because... Without having read something, it's a bit like saying, I love the Hunger Games films.
Yeah.
I've read the books and I love the films even more.
Yeah.
But there was an entire possibility that I read the books and then I fucking hate the films.
Yeah. Do you feel that a lot of the people, when they're dealing with this, forget that it's okay to leave certain things out because the books are always there?
Yeah.
Do you think the creators struggle with that?
Yeah, I think they do. I think they do. And I think the thing is you can't put everything in.
No.
You can't. And you will always be disappointed.
And they try to micromanage and they just still don't...
But I think the thing is, you've just got to accept the fact that you're going to have some people that don't like it.
Yeah.
And there's nothing you can do about that. I think with regards to his Dark Materials, it's very difficult for me to really make a judgment. I think both series so far are really good. I've really enjoyed
them. You came away from season one a little bit like scratching your head going, I have no fucking idea where this is going.
And I feel a bit better
but
after seeing season two.
But I think that is the best reaction to get from it. Because that's what you get from the books. I got from the books.
Yeah.
What the fuck? It's about a girl who misbehaves and runs across rooftops. She has a demon that's her soul. And all of a sudden we're going into like angels and demons territory. And you're kind of like, what the fuck? And it drives you and motivates you on. Whereas I have all that insight. I know where these characters are going.
Yeah, yeah.
So you... And
well, I think that ruins it for you sometimes.
It does.
Because you're constantly predicting it. And you're going, well, that didn't happen in the book. Or it didn't happen like that in the book.
You want to contradict the fucking piece in general.
Of course you do. Of course you do. And I think that stops you from enjoying the art.
Yeah. I did eventually pull myself out of that when we got into season two.
Yeah, you were much better.
I was just like, you know what? I'm going to sit back and I'm just going to watch this and I'm just going to try and enjoy it. Like, even though you've come from watching The Golden Compass and you know that was boring, you don't see those similarities to the extent that I did.
No,
not at all, because you're going in almost fresh-faced.
I try and forget about what I've been doing, honestly. I mean, there's very few things that I can genuinely walk into and go, I know exactly what's going to happen.
Mm.
And to be honest, the only time I ever do that is, like, horror movies, because you always know what's going to happen. There's going to be jump scares.
It's generic,
it's the only thing
you
get, exactly. It's the only thing you can predict.
Yeah.
I think with stuff like this, you, for me, personally, I would ruin it for myself if I tried to... prepare myself for it by thinking about The Golden Compass, thinking about what I, you know, if I'd read it, thinking about what I've read. It just ruins the art. It really does.
Yeah.
And actually, I mean, season two was...
Were you daunted by season two? Or, because you did turn around and go, eh? And I went, trust me, it will become a little bit more, not self-explanatory, but things will start becoming a little bit clearer and later.
I think the thing is, I mean, what I've just said is kind of contradictory to what I'm about to say, which is if it weren't for the fact that you said at the end of season one, it will explain itself, I wouldn't have watched it.
Yeah.
if it weren't for the fact that you've said I've read the books, that there trust would be, me,
yeah.
then I wouldn't have continued, and I probably wouldn't have liked season one because there wasn't enough. The thing is, as a general viewer who hasn't read the books, and I know that might not be what they're catering for, but you've got to cater for general audience as well.
And don't Jay weren't with season one.
No, not at all, because the thing is, I'm watching it, I'm going, I don't even know what the fuck you're talking about.
You need
to give me little hints of answers so that I'm ready and raring to go for the second series, and I think that was the problem with series one.
I think they did eventually realise it, because the last episode or two of season one, they're like, we need to bring in the real element so it's of a familiar place, because his reality is our reality.
Yeah, that still wouldn't have been enough for me if it weren't for the fact that you'd said, stick with it.
And I turned around and went, dust is, you know, just like physics.
Yeah, yeah. I think series two was fantastically better than
Oh, it's amazing. Actors are more comfortable, obviously.
I really enjoyed it. I think there was a bit where in series one, Daphne King was almost a little bit too young, whereas now she's a bit more relatable because she's kind of more of a young woman than she is a child.
Petulant beyond belief and really fucking annoying.
Yeah, that's
But we know she can carry years beyond her actual age as through Logan. What she does in that fucking film, no normal 10-year-old could do that in a movie.
No, absolutely, but I think it's not necessarily her, it's the character alongside her. It is the character.
Lyra is really
petulant
and not the most likable character.
I think from my point of view, I really enjoyed it. I think series two has made up for lost love in series one for me personally. I know a lot of people out there will probably say, how can you possibly say anything if you haven't read or really enjoyed or properly
You're coming from it, experiences dark materials through the television realm. Yeah,
which makes me want to read the books, and actually I think I prefer it that way anyway. Yeah. Because if you read the books first, you always do it. You always do that. You read the book, then you watch the film and you go, oh yeah, but this is different and that's different. Or in this situation, it's obviously a series, but you will always constantly compare. And I think that does, it ruins the art.
Yeah.
And I find it much easier to watch something and turn the watch off while I'm reading. Yeah. Whereas I find it much more difficult, and you probably understand this, I find it much more difficult to turn off the red when you're watching.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I can forget that I've watched it when I'm reading, but I can't forget that I've read it when I'm watching. I think because your mind can wander a bit when you're watching a film. When you're reading, you have to be
fully engrossed. You have to undivided attention.
Yeah. Whereas in a film, you don't.
Yeah.
You can sit and eat popcorn.
Yeah.
You know, you can check your phone, sit with
someone. I mean, to be honest, we're notorious for that. And then the benefit of being at home is you can just fucking rewind it. Or pause it. But or turn around and want confirmation.
You've still got those things in your head.
I'm surprised that but that's probably why I tick a lot whilst I watch certain films.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot, and it's
there's a lot going on behind the scenes.
But yeah, season one I'd give 3 stars. Season two I'd give 5. I fucking loved it. The production value, the performances, the writing, and just its assuredness. The woman who played it, Miss Coulter, to begin with, Wilson. What's her bloody name?
Ruth
Wilson. Her face, it's just a face I've never taken to.
Yeah, but I think that works well for the character.
Oh, definitely. When it goes into number two, season two,
you realise how perfect her casting is.
Her casting, she's always been a really good actress. Mm. But when I saw her in the first one, I'm like, did they cast you purely on that bitch face? And
she's very good, though. She's very melodramatic and it works.
She has this perfect balance, and it's that unpredictability of the character of Miss Coulter.
Mm.
Is she Ms. now? It is Ms. because she's Mrs. Coulter. Mrs. Coulter, because she is unpredictable. She is distant from her own soul. She is cold, calculated, but she's also very conflicted.
Mm.
I mean, there is so much deep down. The greatest issue I actually have with casting is Lin-Manuel Miranda, who plays Lee Scoresby. No, he is such a pivotal character. And you get a sense even from the series, because they shout at you, I gotta look out for Lyra. I gotta look after that little girl. Dude, you spent like 2 minutes on screen with her and you think we're meant to feel this? Whereas in the book, you do. So instead of showing it, they tell it in exposition in the series. I do not like that. You need to show us. We need to see Daphne King as Lyra. Manuel geezer who loves to do really over-the-top accents, who's a musical person, who plays Lee Scoresby. We need to see that on-screen chemistry instead of putting it in exposition, because it didn't work. Because, spoiler alert, when he dies, I'm like, who gives a fuck?
I felt like I should have cried. I felt nothing.
The series is screaming at you for exposition and how he's boasting, I've got a quest, I've got to look after this little girl, I like the sky, yee-haw! I like to shoot my pistols, but I'm a man of good moral standing. Look at my hair rabbit. Look at my hair rabbit. Look at her. Don't you like her ears? Yes, we get it. Okay.
She's cuter.
But you keep going on and on and on about this quest, your connectivity with her. We haven't seen it, we haven't felt it. So when you...
And then he just died.
I've done that thing with Serafina Pecola. I felt nothing because she's introduced far too late in the series. Mm. So there are issues inherent, but you can look over that because overall... I'm so disappointed that I can't remember his name. The boy who plays Will. Oh my god, why have I just... I had his name in the back of my head just now.
I'm working on it. Emil Wilson.
He is the reason that I continue wanting to watch. He's not just his journey as a character, but you can see his journey as an actor as well on screen. And also, this is the purest form of performance because it's so real. He's not playing it up to any ninth degree. He's not being all that all super sweet kid. He shows the vulnerabilities. He shows the love. I just love him, and I think he's going to go on to huge fucking things. His performance is what gripped me. Daphne Keane, I know she's a capable actress, and as her relationship alongside his evolves, you love it. So when they do split up at the end of season two, you feel it. You're like, oh, fuck, I loved seeing them on screen together. Mm. And you're willing on for that reunion, for them to reunite. And outside of my experience with the books and knowing what happens, for that series to make me feel that even more, maybe it's lent by my history of the books, I don't know. But outside of the books, I was invested in their on-screen chemistry as actors, part of this piece of... theatrical theatre, outside of what I know is going to happen. I was purely motivated, not from my relationship with the book and knowing where it goes, but from their on-screen chemistry. And also Daphne Keane's dad, Will Keane, playing a slimy, you know, almost bitch boy head of the magisterium. I just like that. She was obviously like, look, my dad's an out-of-work British actor. Go on, give him a role. Oh, thank you, Daphne. I brought you into this world and you're now, you know, giving me...
Bringing me back into the world of TV.
Yeah. But they're very supportive, because I remember watching the special features of Logan and her mum and her dad. They're there. They're basically, not agents, but they're like that. They're her just parents as well, and mentors and all that. So obviously it was that thing of, I need to pay the rent, Daphne. Oh, I won't loan you money. Just come star in this series. You get that sense, don't you? But he's a very good actor himself. I mean, it's really funny. You don't see much character arcs of the Magisterium, which is a representation of, let's say, the Christian church, Catholic church, all forms of religion. There's no character arcs in the stories, per se, in the books. So I really liked that they did show the humanity behind this.
Yeah.
Magisterium, and also their very biased and twisted attitudes. You get a fuller picture, and that's what I really liked about Jack's adaptation of The Subtle Knife. And you know, he was just like, you know what, I'm adapting it my way. I'm not going to be beholden by the book and its scripture. So yeah, I really enjoyed season two, and I can't wait until 2022 Christmas when the final season is out. I just feel like 8 episodes isn't enough, though.
Well, we shall see.
So, what is your ratings for the seasons?
I agree with you, actually. 3 for the first, 5 for the second.
Brilliant.
Songbird.
Mmm.
Something that we saw advertised...
A while ago.
Some time ago. About the very contagious... Contagious? Contagious COVID disease virus. Doesn't it? I love cans.
Kango Orange, if you'd like to sponsor that. Sorry, cans only.
Yeah, so it's all about the coronavirus pandemic.
Oh, so, so topical. Now it don't seem topical because we've been in it so fucking long.
It just seems like normal life now.
But at the time when it came out, it was like we're being the first movie that's dealing with this.
But pandemic. Based in America, you know, man meets woman. They're sort of late teenagers, early 20s, aren't they? He's a delivery driver. He's immune. She lives with her grandma, and he accidentally delivered a parcel to her house and in error.
And they built a relationship from there.
Which is very sweet.
And he's got a high up there. He's got some high, like, top tier level customers.
Oh, yeah. That
rich customers that, you know, he benefits from off and on, tipping him nicely and all such and sundry. It's basically the world that the American filmmakers involved would envision. What is it? How far has it mutated by this point in their world?
Oh, God, it's like, I can't remember. It's like they've renamed it like COVID 25 or something.
It's a very, very ingenious, clever concept. Done.
Terribly.
It is the most boringest film imaginable. And it's got Michael Bay involved, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, something happens.
Nothing.
I mean, you know,
horny old man goes out and wants to blackmail a wannabe singer who's no better than a prostitute at this point.
Yeah, and that story actually would have made a nicer storyline than the rest of it, to be honest. It was just, you know,
I liked Demi Moore. I liked her character arc, and when it came to a head there, when it was about,
oh, yeah,
I need to protect my daughter, and he's like, look, I'm just here because I need the, because they are doing illegal immunity bracelets. And they're running a big scheme. Demi Moore, haven't seen her in a film in ages. I really liked seeing her.
Yeah, but that wasn't enough to make the film, unfortunately.
No, it's shit. It's boring.
Yeah, I mean, and nothing happened. Literally, the girl's grandma catches COVID and dies. She's then likely to get taken away.
There's a mad man who's on the black market but isn't on the black market, and he's actually one of the heads of sanitation, corroboration.
But none of it really made any sense. None of it really made... It was very, unfortunately, very American, you know, the kind of almost that nature of ridiculousness.
The thing is, what whoever came up with the idea, because they obviously, the genesis of this came in the early stages, but by the time this film has come out, we know a lot more about it.
Yeah.
The hand sanitisation, how it actually works, how it crosses over. So everything that this has evolved and the notion of it is void. It's not that realistic, because as time has gone, and this isn't, I've said this, I like movies and books that capture something, and we've had this conversation on a podcast about Woody Allen saying, never ever do something that's set in a certain time, because later in the years it won't have any relevancy. Mm. I really shouted him down about that, but in connotation with this,
yeah,
it's true.
Right,
if you're trying to represent a certain time that is still very unclear in its machinations and the way it works, yeah, a lot of the ideas and notions that they think, oh, in the early stages of the pandemic,
it makes sense,
but not now, as things have become.
Well, they're talking about clearer. They're talking about the virus mutating and stuff, and that wasn't something that we'd really anticipated in the first lockdown in the UK, anyway. And when it first came out, and then, you know, since then we've had a crap load of mutations and different variants and stuff. So actually, watching this, it was kind of like, yeah, okay, cool.
It is a catastrophized vision of the future.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I mean, it makes for a good entertainment and good, like, you know, film, but not in this case. It wasn't well made. It was boring, it was shoddy, and it was long in the tooth, and it had no right to be.
Precisely. So, rating?
Oh, I gave it 1 star.
I would agree.
So, Songbird gets 1 star.
Now to go on to The Witches versus Roald Dahl's The Witches.
Which is actually Robert Zemeckis' Roald Dahl's The Witches. Fuck that movie. We withheld from doing it. I think we even mentioned it in a podcast long, long ago.
Yeah, so Zach bought the 2020 version of the Roald Dahl's The Witches, which we watched. Zach hadn't seen the 1990 version of The Witches.
Shameful.
I said, you have to watch it before we podcast about it. Zach disagreed before agreeing with me and saying, yes, you're absolutely right. So...
yes, you're absolutely right. Please, don't whip me.
From the 2020 version, we got a fantastic idea of how to make a sundae.
Yeah.
An ice cream sundae.
Yeah.
From the 1990 version of The Witches, we got happiness and joy.
And a decent movie that I loved. I do remember moments of it and parts of it. When I was watching it, I was I remember that bit. But overall, it was a blank slate. I was just like, and you know what? It just proves the laziness that's inherent. Also, Warner Brothers, you spent $150 million. You added nothing to it. You made it ugly with visual effects. It was a shot by shot of the original, whilst inverting it with a stupid American Black Lives ghettoisation that had no message. It had no resonance.
You want my chicken wings? You want grandma's chicken wings?
Disingenuous and disrespectful. For the representation. It also clarified something. Chris Rock really needs to stay the fuck away from anything film related, especially when it comes to being in front of a microphone. We got doing all that for our movie. I know I get those witches. Shut the fuck up, dude. You think Chris Rock is energising this limp biscuit of a film? This isn't like one of those where you dump a rich tea in and it goes. No. This is, it just goes on the bottom. What was that?
The front door. I think.
This episode for Defunkabrot. Sweat drenched press. No rules, no agenda, no full ideals. Just pure experimental literature. Sweat drenched press. www.sweatdrenchedpress.webador.uk. Zorok, Zorotikilit, Verbalin. It's Zach and Laura.
Exciting.
Thought your mum was like, shut the fuck up, kids.
Well, so did I. Thought might be the neighbours.
So anyway, where were we? Yeah, throw 150 million at something that you tried to recreate shot for shot. You added nothing. If anything, you've made something very disingenuous by inverting it with a complete different culture that has no relevance or stakes in the overall story. Also, by getting Chris Rock, you think you're energising the film? No, you're just generally alienating a general audience. Also, what did that 150 million go towards?
Rats.
The visual effects weren't even nice. Up there. Robert Zemeckis, you should be ashamed of yourself. You should be ashamed of yourself. Ugly. Ugly, disingenuous, and just disrespectful to a perfect classic. A movie that was made for at least 2% of the budget you had, that you recreated anyway. Disgusting. Just, I fucking hate you, Robert Zemeckis. I hate you all involved. You disingenuous, cash-grabbing wankers.
Just to sum up, after what Zach has just said, Hathaway, quit your career, love.
Because it ain't going nowhere after this.
Yeah, you ain't going to be Angelica Houston anytime soon.
No.
So, the 1990 version rating, please?
5 stars.
Agreed.
The Witches, it don't get nothing. It gets a sloppy Joe splat. A sloppy Joe, which you know is a nasty burger. For the Americans out there, it's a sloppy Joe. It's a turkey. It's just awful. It's roadkill. It is roadkill. You see this turkey off in the distance and it's beautiful and you think, I'll have you for Christmas. And then all of a sudden, you're like, oh, that's what I'm left with.
0 stars then.
None. It is awful. It's disingenuous. I don't like this whole tick listing. Let's get black cast members, for the sake of looking, you know, concurrent. That's disingenuous and that's even more racist.
Also,
the pantomime nature of it. Sorry, this film's infuriated me to the sense of it's pointless. It doesn't have any reason or recourse to exist. Loads of people keep going, Guillermo del Toro, this guy, that guy. They are only producers in the sense that they were attached to this material years ago. And they, these big directors themselves, really good directors, but Robert Zemeckis used to be, decided themselves to go, there's no point. We can't add anything to it. Alfonso Cuarón, Guillermo del Toro, they were involved with a product years ago, and they only got a, what do they call it? Like a, because they were past associated with the film,
yeah.
they're getting a thingy bob credit. It's like a,
it's like an associative credit, isn't it?
It's like they've got an executive producer credit as a nod, like, yeah, these guys attempted it, and this is, they've been with it for years. And
it's kind of like crediting your ex for providing your child, but not really getting to actually have anything to do with it.
Exactly that. Those two filmmakers didn't know what they could do. Why the fuck Robert Zemeckis thought he could? And a lot of people dislike Robert Zemeckis because his infatuation with visual effects and his leaning in on visual effects more so than anything else. I like Robert Zemeckis' motion capture movies. I love them because that's actually a spirit of Robert Zemeckis. Here, this guy literally was just like, yeah, I'm just going to put my name towards it, get a big budget, and yeah, nice payday. Lazy motherfucker. I'm going to end it on this. Roald Dahl's The Witches is the worst fucking film I've ever watched. It is painful. It's not even got any semblance of what Robert Zemeckis was popped up. Oh, I've got to stop because I won't shut up. Let's go to the next one.
Dunkirk.
Oh, don't get me started on that! Would you like to do a synopsis? I need to calm down.
I'm actually going to read a synopsis from...
Because is there actually anything that happens in this film?
Well, no, not really. So, hence the reason why I'm going to get the synopsis up, because I haven't got a chance in hell. Right, in May 1940, Germany advanced into France, trapping Allied troops on the beaches of Dunkirk. Under air and ground cover from British and French forces, troops were slowly and methodically evacuated from the beach, using every serviceable naval and civilian vessel that could be found.
This movie is Christopher Nolan at his laziest. This is Christopher Nolan who's gone... Well, they didn't acknowledge all of my other warranted masterpieces. I'm going to do a war movie. Because what filmmaker of my calibre, you know, would not do a war movie? He did it because he wanted the nomination. He did it because he's Christopher Nolan. He did it because he is Christopher Nolan and he is working off of that aegis. I'm Christopher Nolan. I can do everything and anything I want now, and it can be half of anything that I've ever created or put on screen, because name alone, I am a revolutionary, as boasted throughout the marketing for Tenet. You ain't a revolutionary. You're just boring.
I mean, I think the only good thing about it was the fact that we had Kenneth Branagh and Harry Styles in it, to be honest.
And we came up with a beautiful song. It was like something to do with... I don't want to drown high, or something like that. Those moments need to be captured. That's why we need a GoPro and we do like these film viewings to come up with our most like ingenious gags.
I know.
But yeah.
Bastards!
Fucking bastards! I think that this movie technically is good, it's hollow. It is disingenuous again. Oh, we're telling a story that not many people know. No. You've got to realise, us British, we're not patriotic like the Americans. Is it like this Americana flavour? Like we're proud of the war that we contributed to or helped out in? We're not patriotic. We're quite secreted about our involvement in any war. Excuse me, we downplay it. We downplay it because we don't want to glamorise it. We don't want to glorify it. And Nolan thinks that he's paying tribute to these people. You're not paying tribute, you're just taking something to your advantage and being overly disingenuous with it. You wanted an Oscar, you got your Oscar nod, well done. You made a very boring film that didn't need to cost 250 fucking million, but no, you had to repurpose airplanes and re-blow them up. Oh no, you had to actually film on Dunkirk Beach so you could capture the essence. Oh, fucking suck on this, you fucking cunt. Sorry.
Rated?
It's gone down from 2 to 1.
Good. I would also give it 1. Let's move to something a little nicer. What about The Dig?
Oh.
Yeah. I thought I might cheer you up because the rest is just shit, isn't it?
Oh, that was... No, the host isn't.
Okay, well, sure. I have shit to say about it, but go on.
Oh, The Dig. What? Oh, it's just lovely. Heartbreaking in so many facets and fashions.
I wanted them to fall in love.
I think the love was there. It was a love, but it was a different form of love.
Yeah, it wasn't not like one a we anticipated. Romantic love, was it?
It was a mutual respect.
Yeah.
He's a hard grafter labourer who never got his dues. And
let me see if I can find a synopsis.
And he literally felt that with her. It's basically just about the digging up of not just an architectural or a historic piece artifact. I mean, not architectural artifact. It is about digging up one's emotions and exposing something, you know, deep down inside of themselves.
The official synopsis is: in the late 1930s, wealthy landowner Edith Pretty hires amateur archaeologist Basil Brown, played by Ralph Fiennes, to investigate the mounds on her property in England. He and his team discover a ship from the Dark Ages whilst digging up a burial ground. Now, I think, unfortunately, that synopsis makes it sound like the most boring film.
The film on a subsurface level is boringest thing ever.
There's nothing to it.
So there is nothing to it, but it's about the characters, it's about the stories, it's about the engagements. Even Lily James's character's arc I was invested in. And yeah. You know me, I don't like Lily James since it's come out that she's a homewrecker, bitch.
It was lovely.
Beautiful. Beautifully shot. Ralph Fiennes, I mean, even playing like a old hand farmer, it's like, I'd pull down your dungarees and slap that arse. It was just lovely. Carey Mulligan, brilliant. And I mean, yes, there's not much to it, but you've got to look underneath the layers of this excavational dig. There is more to it than what is on the subsurface. Anyway, I give it 5 stars. I loved it.
I would agree.
If anything, it's a movie that you shouldn't pick apart. You should just let it wash over you. There's a love story in there. There is a love story in there. It's also talking about, you know, prejudices, sexuality, life. Also, the cruelty of certain academic structures that will, no matter your achievements and no matter the amount of work you put in, those up above you will squash you and will basically bury you, ironically. And it's only 3 years later, by dedicated study and actual historic, you know, archivists and historians, that someone like him actually, you know, deserves.
He gets credited for what he's done.
He gets credited for what he's done, and he didn't just he didn't just discover something from the Dark Ages architecture. He discovered something about himself, and also enabled Carey Mulligan's character to discover something about herself as well. Mm. And also a kinship with her son. It's beautiful. It's a film that needs to be felt and experienced rather than picked apart.
Yeah, absolutely. Next up is Host. So, 6 friends accidentally invite the attention of a demonic presence during an online seance and begin noticing strange occurrences in their home.
I mean, fucking great. I loved it. I like being scared, though, when it comes to horror films.
It was very well made, but I very much disliked it because I don't like being scared. So I can appreciate for what it was. I can appreciate how well it was made. I can appreciate how well it was made, given that they were trying to do it under COVID restrictions during lockdown.
They were literally
really challenging.
Doing it virtually.
Yeah, so that must have been really hard.
A virtually
so
made
was,
film.
Yeah, and I think it was fantastically made, and for that I will give it 4 stars. But I don't like horror films, no. So
I mean, that's still quite a good rating.
Yeah, because I think the whole thing was fantastic. I only knock the 5th star off because I don't like horror movies. Mm. That's the only thing.
You
I
don't
can
need to apologise for it, because I gave it 4 stars.
Fair enough.
I don't have much more to say. It is what it is. It is a
I thought it was going to be really cheesy and ridiculous, to the point that I laughed at the first jump.
The I don't know what they categorise these films under. Are they to do with the social media type?
I'm not entirely sure, actually. I'm trying to see if it will say
up, down, up again. They usually say it next to up, up, up.
British found footage horror.
Found footage, okay. So there's a lot of, you know, found footage films, Paranormal Activity, all that. It's kind of a dying breed now, these types of movies. And when they are made, they are just laughable. It's kind of really, it's taken that mode, that creative filmic device that is really trite now, isn't it? It's dead in the water. And you kind of go...
But I think it's dead because we have as much technology as we do now.
Yeah.
Because everything overexposure, just looks really old. Yeah.
Overexposure to it as well. And what they've done is is he called Rob Savage, the director? He's kind of revolutionised that methodology. In all honesty, I don't want him to be pigeonholed where he makes these movies going on. I want him to be able to, you know, explore himself as a filmmaker, because he's not just that found footage guy. He's got short films out there before this, and he recently got contracted by Blumhouse Pictures, who we've got a great affinity with, film-wise, not that we've got a relationship with them, and they've given him $30 million contract. He's not getting paid 30 million, but it's a 30 million film contract, which means that money is going to be extended for, let's say, their maxim is per movie 5 million only. So this is shows we want to make at least 6 films of you. And I mean, from the strength of a movie like this that was made within 12 weeks, gained notoriety because it was a prank to begin with, something that started as a prank and has now turned into a real good career for him. Well fucking done. But also for the crew, makeup artists, producers, actors, all involved, well done. Well fucking done. Because, you know, if you put your heart and soul into it and, you know, you're all together and behind it, great things can come from it. You can achieve greatness. And I mean, if your heart is so fully behind it, it will work.
Yeah,
it will work, and it will pay dividends. And then from going on from, you know, being just streamed on Shudder, which is a notorious horror-only streaming service, to then being screened internationally in cinemas, which is a rarity considering that this movie doesn't go beyond a 60-minute length time, which is very clever because it's very fitting within the whole...
You're only allowed 40 minutes on Zoom.
And unless you upgrade, and which no one wants to do that, even like if you're on a dating site, he wants to upgrade to that. To then go on to be recognised for a movie, you know, that could easily have been just put on as a straight to DVD thing. I think what happened was they got the right
production company.
They've got the right. I can't get my fucking word. They've got the right team behind them, and they've got the right marketing people, because this could have easily have just found itself, you know, hidden amongst all the other fan footage films. But this was pushed out there, marketed to the max, and you know what? It deserves it. It isn't overrated. It's a very, very effective, intense experience, and I fucking loved it. 4 stars from me, and I'm very happy that, you know, something that is such a labour of love is going to pay dividends for all involved, the producers, the cast, the makeup things, and I hope they as a unit will go on to do amazing and bigger, better things, because as I said, this could easily have just been, oh, it's niche, we can do it direct to DVD, make enough of it, and then you're going to be pigeonholed as this one certain type of filmmaker, But luckily enough, he isn't. He's being recognised as a filmmaker force. And again, this movie is outside of just Rob Savage. It is Rob Savage, wasn't it? He's savage in what he does. Savage being like wicked in the UK vernacular. Anyway, 4 stars for host.
Next up is The Death Watch. Not The Death Watch. Just Death Watch.
MJ Bassett.
In 1917, 9 British soldiers find themselves lost in enemy territory on the Western Front. They take refuge in a corpse-filled, rat-infested enemy trench where they wait for rescue. As night falls, however, the men sense that they are not alone, and soon they begin to die one by one.
They literally just fall into a pocket in time where they're just put through purgatory.
Yeah.
And that's not made clear at all until you, like, let the film settle for a couple of days. There's some...
Still not enough in there for me to look back and go, that makes sense
There's still... what are they called? Aspersions? Oh. There's certain... Come on, you're meant to be smart.
You've just used a word I have no idea what you're talking about.
They throw out a couple of things that, you know, eventually will lead to, I'll piece that together. I mean, production-wise, it looks good. I've got a thing about mud in movies. I just love mud. I just love mud in general, the aesthetic, the feel, the weight of it. For all the production and the low budget of this, I liked it. I really liked it. I enjoyed it. It was different. It was really different from, you know, what could have easily been a zombie World War II film, a World War I film, mm-hmm. whatever it was.
Well.
And instead it was a very, quite dense, almost metaphysical, psychological monster flick without any monster. The monster is the characters, the monster within each of them. The only issue is Jamie Bell.
Mm-hmm.
It was fucking awful. Awful. Terrible in it. But everyone else, top. I really enjoyed it. I liked the characters. This was MJ Bassett's directorial debut. As a directorial debut, it's like, well, fucking done. Mm-hmm. Because she could have easily have just made a movie that, you know, that kind of subtracted from the psychological elements and then became just a classic monster movie. It didn't. It was very almost allegorical in its execution, and it was a very cosmic film.
Mm-hmm.
In all honesty, as much as I enjoyed it, it was quite boring in places.
I really struggled.
Yeah.
There wasn't enough answers.
No.
Too many questions.
Yeah.
And even at the end when you think, oh yeah, this is all making sense, it did not make sense, and no. I still can't look back at it and go, that makes sense now, because it still doesn't really make sense.
It's picking at straws, kind of, with what is offered to you.
It was a clever idea.
Yeah.
But the idea wasn't, it wasn't explained enough to make it clever enough to make a good movie for me.
Well, I gave it 3 stars.
I will, at a push, give it 3.
Okay.
Okay, so inmate zero, when a medical experiment on prisoners goes horribly wrong, a remote island becomes a terrifying disease-riddled maze for the desperate survivors. I've kind of come around to the idea of zombie movies. They weren't really my thing before, were they?
But we kind of watched. Which one we've watched you've really liked?
Yeah.
Survival. We've got a thing about survival.
Yeah. I think the thing is with this, though, I don't know. There was part of it that was just like, there just really was no, it's like you're not going to survive this. So then it kind of becomes less of a survival, more of a just watching their fates come true.
Yeah, yeah.
Which then kind of makes it a bit boring. Yeah.
Yeah. You know how it's going to pay off. I did not understand the whole, what I would assume, dreamscape, metaphorical, filmic vista of her reaching out to her mother, because there's no information afforded to deserve that payoff. I didn't get it. I didn't like it. I think it was trying to invert a cleverness that the film didn't need.
Because
these films,
they're basic.
They don't need to be clever.
No.
Just make it a tense experience with some really gory gags. I mean, for a very low-budget movie, I mean, great gore.
The makeup was phenomenal.
Great effects, great use of camera, cinematography. Some of the acting was up there, and I mean, I think you need to get something up, an audio clip it, to personify some of the quality inherent in this film.
Are you hinting at something that I'm not getting?
Yeah, the twat.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. I completely forgot about that. I'm sitting there going, bastards, fucking bastards. That's not this film. That was a TV show. Did I record it on camera? No, I didn't. How did I record it?
Did you cut it?
I've got to try and find it, though, because it wasn't all the way through.
1 minute. Anyway, yeah. So, this is
the best quote from this film.
I'm thinking, Crystal, you mouthy twat.
You still got.
I'm thinking, Crystal, you mouthy twat.
I mean, it's very British. It's for a very limited budget. It had, you know, it really excelled where it should. It also had better visual effects than fucking Greenland. Greenland.
That's true.
Greenland, Greenland. Anyway, I'd give this film 3 stars. It's effective where it should work. The main actress can't act herself her way out of a paper bag. I mean, if they really wanted her to cry on set, they should have picked up that sand and thrown it in her eyes instead of sticking it to her face. I love the characters of the women, the prisoners, especially Butcher.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, man, real proper Jamaican, curry goat, a butcher you fam. Loved her arc and her interrelationship with the mute character of whom I completely forgot her name. But Russell Owen, well done, mate. Also, what is so effective about this is it allows actual tension. The thing with these survival zombie flicks is it goes into the realm of action movie, whereas this isn't about action and, you know, mutilations and shooting off limbs and being blood spurts and CGI, you know, splatters. It's actually about the characters and the survival. But like you said, it kind of loses track when you know they're all just cannon fodder. But I really enjoyed it. I really liked its very retrograde, wink, wink, nudge, nudge to the original 2 Resident Evil games. Johannes Probert, Roberts, or whatever his name is doing the new reboot of the Resident Evil. But I know that Sony is really pushing for a new Resident Evil franchise film. And I think higher Russell Owens, I think he would do on a bigger budget. I think if he had a bigger budget and some certain, you know, better cast members, this film would have been maybe a 4-star film. But for what it is, 3 stars. And its original title was Patience of the Saint, which
kind of makes more sense in some ways.
Because it did have a lot of religioso.
It did.
Allegory and bite and zest and exposition. But anyway.
So 3 stars for Inmate Zero.
Inmate Zero, I keep saying impatient.
Okay, so Greenland. Family fights for survival as a planet-killing comet races to Earth. John Garrity, which is Gerald Butler, his estranged wife Alison, Marina Baccarin, and young son Nathan make a perilous journey to their only hope for sanctuary. Amid terrifying news accounts of cities around the world being levelled by the comet's fragments, the Garrities experience the best and worst in humanity while they battle the increasing panic and lawlessness surrounding them. As the countdown to global apocalypse approaches zero, their incredible trek culminates in a desperate and last-minute flight to a possible safe haven.
Oh, what?
The first hour, you can't do that because it was good. And I was like, shit, it's been an hour and it had gone really quickly and we were really enjoying it. And you said at that time, didn't you? I went, oh my God, it's been an hour already. And you were like, yeah, because it's a good film.
Yeah, I spoke too soon.
And then you ate your words very, very quickly after that, didn't you?
I did. Like that dog on Dogs Behaving Badly, I was truffling in my own shit.
That you were. I don't quite know what happened. I'm very disappointed in Gerard Butler.
I mean, I'm not surprised because it's the same geezer who directed the last Gerard Butler film I saw on the big screen, which was the travesty that was Angel Has Fallen. Angel Has Fallen is the shittiest film ever.
I love that film.
It's awful. Terribly directed, terribly written. It's not personifying what came before. Olympus and Batman Has Fallen are brilliant movies. That third film was fucking awful.
I'm not
going to
say that Angel Has Fallen was better than Olympus and London, but I still loved it.
Because you like Jared Butler. And that's okay. I like Jared Butler, who actually, you know, uses his own Scottish accent.
Yeah, I don't quite know what happened. It got to the point where ran out of ideas.
Mm.
It just got to a point where we're just the same shit all over again.
Did it need to be 1 hour and 51 minutes? No. It could have easily just been 1 hour and 20 minutes. The whole granddad shit didn't need to. It prolonged it, the whole going to a dad's.
I think it would have been sadder if her dad was dead. Not sitting there playing poker.
Yeah, he hung himself because he knew it was inevitable. Some steaks. There's no steaks. Yeah. And I like, you know, chips and peppercorn sauce with my steaks.
Yeah, I know. So, rating?
Two.
Two. Next up.
Oh, no, it's not open water, is it?
No, it's not.
What is it?
It's a grudge.
Oh, fuck that noise. I ain't got nothing to say about it. It is crap.
So...
Have you missed that, ladies and gents?
Yeah, you'll soon realise, ladies and gents, that I have not been successful in shutting Zach up from his...
Scarier than noises in that fucking film.
So, an American nurse living and working in Tokyo is exposed to a mysterious supernatural curse, one that locks a person in a powerful rage before claiming their life and spreading to another victim.
Crap. Didn't need to exist. They added nothing to it. And then trying to make it so emotional. The film is...
Oh, that's not even the right synopsis. I'm sorry.
That is the original.
That's the original. After a young housewife murders her family in her own house, a single mother and young detective tries to investigate and solve the case. Later, she discovers the house is cursed by a vengeful ghost that dooms those who enter it with a violent death. Now she runs to save herself and her son from demonic spirits from the cursed house in their neighbourhood. Basically, she is unsuccessful.
Yeah.
And she tries to burn the curse down and takes it to her own house, where she kills, possibly. She doesn't actually kill anyone. We think she's going to kill somebody. It was... the only thing I found about it was that it was unnerving when they're doing that, like, bone-crunching, clicking thing. It's not nice. Please stop. I will hurt you.
Why?
It just puts me on edge. It's kind of like nails down a blackboard. It makes me feel... cringy.
Oh, like the scraping of that chair in Inmate Zero.
Yeah, yeah.
Linoleum.
I don't know what it does. It's just...
And you don't like scary faces jumping out the blue. So, yeah, this film was made for you. That rhymed. I didn't mean it to. But woohoo. Woohoo.
Well done. Yeah. Wow. What a shit show.
Yeah, I give it half a star. Because I like the actor from Searching.
I won't give it anything.
Yeah, it was crap. It had no reason to exist. Even some of the gore gags were awful. Like when her arm bends backwards, that CGI shot just made me laugh rather than go, ouch.
So next up is your favourite film we've seen in the last few months, weeks.
Oh.
Is Open Water. Daniel and Susan embark on a tropical vacation with their scuba diving certifications in tow. During a group dive, the two separate themselves from the others to dive a little deeper. An incorrect head count suggests the entire group, has returned. And they haven't. So, too, those two people are
ladies
left.
Ladies and gents, instead of going onto a streaming site and going, oh, yeah, Open Water, I remember the trailers on my VHS tapes, when I watched a far better film, where it was, oh yeah, yeah, let's just go watch this, because I remember it was, at the time, really shouted about, and let's watch it. Instead of doing that, pull down the trousers, look at your clitoris or your penis, and for about an hour and 20 minutes, just on occasion, flick it, and you'll get far more satisfaction from doing that than watching this piece of fucking shit.
I think the thing that really frustrated me about this film is the fact that they say that it was based on a true story, but they both died out to sea, and they weren't really like found, and I can't quite understand how you can tell a story.
What happened was they captured the shark, and the shark whisperer was like, "What happened to these two?" And he was like, "Oh, really? Exactly, your point. It's not like their fucking entrails spout out their last, like, surviving thoughts."
Because, like,
but it's a lie anyway, it wasn't.
No, but it's like, at the end, she, like, took off her belt and went underwater to be eaten by the sharks, and I'm like, well, how would you have known that happened if it was... Anyway, it was a pile of wank. It was the most boring thing I think I've ever watched.
It was ugly, 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 made on videotape cameras, and at the time it was niche and cool. How the fuck they managed to earn so much money off of this, and these people then went on to have a career? I have no clue. Awful, awful, awful. Open Water. Open cesspool.
How many stars?
Minus nothing.
That'd be a zero star.
I much prefer a shark bite my cock off. You'll have to watch that again.
That would be unfortunate for me. Three more to go, darling. This has been a very negative podcast with the war films that we've watched recently. So the next is, unfortunately, Blackwater Abyss, which
was decent for the first hour.
I will get the synopsis, please hold. So deep in the forests of Australia, some friends are exploring a remote cave system when a tropical storm hits.
Crikey, look at that hole!
As rising floodwaters trap them deep below the surface, something even deadlier emerges from the darkness.
Crikey, it's
killer
a croc.
Crocodiles.
It's a fucking croc!
I actually kind of enjoyed this film until the last 10-15 minutes where they just fucked it over and over and over until it was sore and bleeding. I just... what the fuck?
Desperation. They could have ended it there and I would have been happy.
Me too. They're driving away like... They survive.
I think they, like, they've been driving for what we assume is, like, 5 minutes, and all of a sudden they crash, and then they end up somehow back in the lake that they came out of.
And then they eventually kill the crocodile. No, it ruined it. It took it from...
For how low budget it was, I thought it was effective, it was scary, it is what it is, it's the B-movie schlock, but they really wanted to go schlock horror at the end, and guess what? It just ruined the remainder of what came before, and that was so respected. Yes, we actually respected your film up until that point for what you were achieving.
We did.
Doesn't make me want to go watch the other ones in the series, though.
No. So...
2 stars.
Good. I would agree. Two more to go, second to last. The rhythm section. Stephanie goes into a downward spiral when she loses her family in a plane crash. Later, on learning that the incident was orchestrated by terrorists, she decides to take revenge.
The first 30 minutes, it was really well paced, really interesting. I liked the on-screen chemistry between Blake Lively and Jude Law. I liked the character's progression.
Yeah.
And then for after they were no longer on screen together... considering this is produced by the Broccolis, you know, their penchant isn't just in the green vegetable. It's actually in the, you know, shaken not stirred territory with a broccoli instead of a olive. The producers behind sensational Bourne films, not. You think there'd be a little bit of heft and oomph and actual intrigue? Because I know how imposing the producers... of Bond are, especially the Broccolis, and how, you know, they want a film to be a certain standard. They obviously put the money up for this, and they're like, yeah, Blake Lively, Jude Law, it's enough. Without having actually watched the final result, it just was dull. It also was like a wannabe Jason Bourne type story, but that of which it really wasn't.
There was nothing to it.
I liked seeing Blake Lively, you know, transform herself, but there was nothing to it. There was no... character development at all. Also, she wasn't even good at what she was doing. So yeah, rhythm section, 1 star.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. It just, I mean, I want this review to be as over as quickly as I wanted the film to be over.
And all the others.
And the last film.
Which one's this?
The Belko Experiment.
Oh, yeah. Fuck, yeah.
An ordinary day at the office becomes a horrific quest for survival when 80 employees at the Belko Corporation in Bogota, Colombia, learn that they are pawns in a deadly game. Trapped inside their building, a voiceover and intercom tells the frightened staffers that 2 workers must be killed within 30 minutes. When another ultimatum follows, friends become enemies and new alliances take shape, as only the strongest will remain alive at the end.
Well, it makes sense that all of Greg McLean's like passion and investment in directing a decent film went into this, because a year later he made the Daniel Radcliffe movie, Borathon, that was Jungle.
Borathon, I like that. I mean, I think I kind of shat on this when I first watched it.
That you did.
I would like to now take that back. Because upon thinking... So this is what happens when you say to me straight away, what did you think of that? Because I can't I can't create a proper opinion on it until I've thought about it.
I'm sorry, I apologise about that.
How many stars?
At least I'm not holding a microphone underneath you and ordering your first impressions. Sorry, that was me trying to reverse psychology. A hiccup that was threatening to escape.
Very badly done.
Yes.
I mean, the Burko experiment kind of reminded me of Saw in some ways. I love Saw. I love that kind of weird, twisted, turning on your friends, turning on your not friends.
Showing your true colours.
I love
you against
that shit.
Others.
I don't know why I love
forcing
it.
Forcing you into a situation that you would not want to be put in.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why I love it, but I just can't help myself.
I'm going to do one for you now. For your survival, you have to kill either me or your mum. Who would you do? But both of us will end up dead if you don't do it.
Is there any specific way that I like have to kill you?
No, you just have to kill one of us, either one of us.
And how would you die if I didn't kill either of you?
Painfully.
No. Yeah, I'd probably kill my mum.
And why would that be? Because she's just had more time than me?
No, because you're my future and she's going to die in my future at some point anyway, so I might as well just kill her off now.
Oh dear, I'm depressing. Anyway, thank you for your candidness. It's lucky your mum doesn't listen to these podcasts. Sorry, Jane.
Anyway, I actually really kind of enjoyed this in a way that I probably shouldn't, because that makes me a little bit sick.
That is why these films appeal, because that.
Yeah, they're just odd.
Outside of reality, you wouldn't be facing such questions outside of fiction.
But they're almost kind of humorous, but in an absolutely not humorous way.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I like
the tension
and
in
stuff.
This, and the ratcheting up, the performances, the dedication to the actors. It's just, you feel it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's like the actors are living it. It's like it's not done in a pseudo documentary style, because the acting is so, and the editing and the cut and the way it's orchestrated and put together as a film, you are so there and in it.
I think the only thing that turned me down from the film in general was Sean Gunn, because I have watched him a hell of a lot recently in Gilmore Girls, and seeing him in the character that he was in just felt ridiculous. And the fact that he used the F word more than once was just heartbreaking, because in Gilmore Girls, he's Kirk, and Kirk is just the most ridiculously annoying man that just wouldn't hurt a fly and wants to impress everyone, and the character in the Belko experiment played by Sean Gunn is just like totally opposite from that, and it just felt really wrong and kind of uncomfortable.
Laura is an actor.
He's Kirk, okay?
No, he ain't. He's nothing like that character at all.
No, I know, but you know what it's like when you've watched hours upon hours upon hours.
Oh, yeah.
Of
it's very hard
something.
To.
Yeah.
You've got your mind set. You are this person.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, yeah, that was the only thing I kind of found difficult. Other than that, I thought it was pretty good. I
didn't like the notion that it didn't give any answers. That was your biggest.
Yeah, that was my biggest bugbear about this film. It didn't give me any answers really at all. And you could tell that it was setting up for
sequel,
a sequel.
But didn't usher in any money. I think it deserved.
I think it did too. I think the problem is with ending with in a way that tends to suggest that a sequel's coming.
It sets itself up for failure.
Yeah.
Because there's a cockiness about it.
Yeah.
But of course.
And it means that I'm interested in seeing a sequel that I'm probably never going to see, which just fucks me off.
No end, yeah.
And it kind of just turns me off of the idea. Yeah. I think that's kind of the reason why when you said, what did you think at the first? I'm like, oh yeah, whatever. Because I'm just angry.
Yeah.
Because I've watched this whole
thing. You want an absolute at the end.
Yeah.
Some form of it.
Yeah. Even if they've given that absolute, but then they've shown the pictures, the videos of all the other people in the different areas doing it to kind of put on like
this.
Well,
the thing is, like with Escape Room, though it was set up for a sequel, it could have just ended there.
That's what I mean. You can do both. And they failed with that, and that, I think, is what left me with such a sour taste in my mouth. I went, yeah, whatever.
You were gagging for more, and then they were like, is it? Isn't it? Yeah. Also, we're going to leave this... Wait, I mean, James Gunn, like I said, the writer of this, has left a real long stream of old tweets where he basically broke down his intent for the series. Mm. Whether or not it's how he feels on the day, because when I read about it... nearer the time, it was like going to be isolated to a few different locations across the world, and then it was going to neatly tie itself up in a bow with like a real insurgence of those who survived for the third film. Went to try and find these tweets, and
they're gone.
Like a lot of James Gunn's old tweets, they've all been eradicated, because I don't know if you knew this, James Gunn's the director of Guardians of the Galaxy and all that, and he's now the...
Oh, you've said this in a very, very, very early podcast when we first started co-hosting. Didn't you say something that was, like, racist or sexist or something?
He said something along the lines of, like, a baby rape joke and something
Now I remember. It was probably one of the first podcasts we've ever done together.
He was basically... He got dropped by Disney and Marvel, and then DC straight away were like, we like the dark side. Let's get James Gunn. And then they gave him the Suicide Squad. And, in the wake of his controversial tweets, I think it's cleared out the majority of his... But I've tried to deep delve into it, and he says it is what it is. I did have bigger ideas, and I'm like, come on, give me some more juice like you did 4 years ago, 3 years ago. But, yeah, James Gunn is a very talented writer. He is a very talented director. As much as I don't like Guardians of the Galaxy 2, I believe in him, and he does stuff that is gritty, dark... He's darkly humorous. I mean, I can't recall the jokes off by hand, but the stuff that he put on Twitter, you know, he was his characteristic and public persona was that underground filmmaker. He tells really inappropriate, dark jokes. Mm-hmm. And then he's getting hung up to dry about it. Mm-hmm. And then he has to kowtow to Disney and Marvel. But when Disney and Marvel saw that DC had picked him up, they went, oh, you can have your job back. And he went, yeah, you can give me my job back, but I'm still making a DC film. And they're like, drats. But yeah, anyway, James Gunn's a very talented writer and director. I'm really surprised he didn't direct this, but because of his name alone and his success with The Guardians, this film wouldn't have got made otherwise. The only thing that I dislike is he financed the shit show that was Brightburn.
Mm.
Yeah. He was one of the pioneers behind it, and two of his other brothers wrote that film.
Oh, God.
They are obviously not the talented Gunns.
No.
Those two.
Absolutely.
Sean, on the other hand, he is. And James Gunn is. I can't wait to see what James Gunn does in the future. Greg McLean, he's also very famous for his Australian outback horror films. Wolf Creek, I haven't watched either of them, but he's famous for it. More survival type stuff. But other than that, yeah, I'd give this a good strong 4 stars.
Oh, I will recommended, agree with you.
Recommended watch. Again, I'd like to know what would happen, but I can't find those sources of information anymore. I can only recall what I read up on the release of this, which was 2016. So what was that, 4 or 5 years ago?
Nearly 5 years ago now.
But yeah, obviously in the wake of his controversial comments, he's like, I'm wiping everything off my Twitter. Which...
Very unfortunate.
He was forced into a stalemate with that, really, wasn't he? But anyway, I think that's it for this episode.
I think it is.
Is there anything you'd like to add about the new website? What is the new website for Sweat Drench Press?
Oh, yeah, Sweat Drench Press. A little update. So we kind of lost our old website because they wanted us to renew and pay...
An extortionate amount.
500% more than we were paying before. And I went, no, because it's such a bastard to actually use... And it was awful, and no. So we do now have a new website, which is as simple as sweatdrenchpress.webador, that's webador.co.uk, and you can go on there, you can have a look on the About Us page, you can have a look at the team within Sweat Drench Press, which is Zach and I and our two associate illustrators slash cover artists, Lydia Swinney and Paul Tone, and then you can see some more information about our authors, which I will not list because there are a number of them and I would not want to try and forget some of them, because I am super good at forgetting names when I'm trying to list them.
I will not want to try and forget their names. No, you will forget their names.
Sorry. You can also order through us now. I just want to explain how that works. The information is on the website as to how much each book costs. You can still purchase things through Amazon. However, we are trying to cut out the middleman, in the sense that Amazon takes a hell of a lot of commission.
Yeah,
from the
that
books.
Bozo Bezos takes his fucking cut.
So, because they take such a huge cut from each purchase, we made the decision that it would be better to actually order the author copies directly for customers to then be sent out. So although Amazon are still printing, and I cannot stress enough, they are still our printers and they are still our delivery guys until, you know, as I've said to Zach before, if things get bigger and we get more and more orders and those orders are consistent, then we will think about setting up a shop and being able to send out our own stuff so that Amazon only ever prints. But until that moment comes, we can't actually sit and take on a huge amount of books to send out to you guys, unfortunately.
And the books will not come to you in a timely fashion like the service Amazon offers. But this is the reality of independent businesses. And someone wrote something really funny online. They said, oh, you're all moaning, you're all Amazon refuse-nits, but you will be the first people to start bitching about independent company of whom can't get a book to you within a timely accord. They said, because that one book, as soon as you get it, where's it going? On a to-be-read pile. This book ain't going to be read straight away. So please take that into account. What you're doing is supporting us and our authors tenfold. You are not lining the pockets of Amazon.
If you think about it like this, this month I will be doing royalty advice notes for our authors for sales in November.
Mm.
This month I will also be able to do royalty advice notes for those same authors for sales made through the press for February. So rather than giving them a 3 to 4 month waiting time for their royalties through Amazon, we can make it a monthly payment for the month that has just gone.
Mm-hmm.
We started doing this in February. I can already say that we've got £30 worth of royalties that needs to obviously be transferred to dollars, euros, and so on and so forth to cover the different authors in the different countries. But my point is the fact that we will be able to give them those royalties by the end of this month, rather than having those royalties waiting around for 3 months' time.
Yeah.
So all I can say really is we are trying our best to cut out the middleman. Until we have a consistent amount of orders coming in, we can't even consider or think about considering any form of shop or delivery of our own until that consistency is there and is there for some time. If we are able to have that, then things will obviously, we'll be able to change things slightly. But until then, we're still going to have to print through Amazon, order through Amazon and deliver to you through Amazon.
And on that note, I would like to say thank you to everyone who has been championing SDP. And also our last and latest release, which was, outside my own, Richard Cabot's Looking for a Kiss. Some really sensational reviews to all the radio programmers, executives who've been having Richard on his show. Also, thank you to Richard for being a real support for Sweatdrench Press. Really and wholly encapsulating it and being really good for our press, like word of mouth, and also really personifying what we are as a press, believing in us. He's not, you know, it's he's proud to be involved with us, and we're as equally proud to be involved with him. And just that everyone who has picked up copies so far directly from via us, it's very heartening, and we'll see where this thing will go. But that is to wrap up today's episode of Articulate Warbling.
It is indeed. It has been a pleasure, as always.
Never a chore. Didn't need to be a multi-parter. I think what benefited us was the majority of those films were so shit, we had no inclination to talk about them.
That's true. So, for now, it's a goodbye from me.
Goodbye from me.